Hola, amigos. This is Billy Sheehan, your bass player from the Winery Dogs. You're listening to me right here on Rock Solid.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself. I can't afford to be. This is small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away. A song away. A song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis. And joining me today in the Zoom room to promote his new album with the Winery Dogs, simply called Three, please welcome legendary bassist Billy Sheehan. Good morning, Billy.
Good morning. Very kind of you to say that. I'll try to live up to that intro.
Well, here's the thing about this band, Billy. I don't know how you feel about the term supergroup, but for me, this truly is a supergroup because everyone in the Winery Dogs is at the top of their game on their instrument, and also Richie on vocals, who I feel is very underrated and not thought of much as a lead vocalist. And together, I mean, you guys are just fantastic.
Well, you're killing me here. You're very kind. Thank you so much. I appreciate the being dubbed some kind of a super group, if you will, but we don't look at it that way, really. We're just kind of three guys that, imagine if we were in the same high school, we probably would have ended up in the same position. And it's kind of like that. We're just looking, guitar player, bass player, and drummer looking to play together, and there we are. We've all done things that we're, you know, we're very, very grateful for, and had a wonderful situations in all of our respective careers. But for us, we just kind of wanted to get together and play and do our thing and make a band and go out and tour. So we never thought of it in any kind of terms as a supergroup, but I do appreciate that you feel that way. It's very kind of you.
Well, you're welcome. And it would probably be weird if I said you guys are a supergroup and you said, of course we are. Yes, indeed. We are a supergroup.
So that would be weird.
I get that would be weird, but I mean, again, fantastic. And I've been able to listen to the new album. It doesn't come out till February 3rd, but I've been listening to it for weeks now. And you guys just nailed it. I mean, it's been, I think, 8 years since Hot Streak. And you guys did it again. So thank you.
Well, thanks. We have a good formula. We just get in a little room and figure out some songs. And it is, in fact, a little room. Richie has moved since the first record. But in his house, initially, it was a tiny little room, almost too small. We'd squeeze in there with a little drum kit and tiny amps. So when he got a nice new house out in the hills, we thought he'd have a little bit more room. But he does. But the room is still tiny that we play in. So we were jammed in there. I'm sitting on the top of a little tiny amplifier, and Mike's got a tiny kit, and we got in a room and wrote and came up with ideas, and Mike, give me a drum beat, or I'll do a bass line, and those guys will jump in, or Richie will have an idea for a guitar chord sequence, and we'll turn into it and talk back and forth and figure it out. And fortunately, all of us have played millions of songs.
Right.
So we've got a big vocabulary of what to do when you need to find a chorus or a bridge to make a song work. Now we got all that stuff finished up and handed it over to our vocalist, Richie, who did a spectacular job of lyrics and melodies and, above all, delivering an incredible vocal performance, in my humble opinion. So he did really a great job on that. We had a gentleman by the name of Jay Rustin mix this record. He mixed the first two records, and we are very, very much pleased with his work, and he outdid himself on this as well. I hear everything that I played, that Richie played, and Mike played, and it comes across very, very well.
Well, Jay Rustin has now produced two of my favorite or been involved in two of my favorite albums from 2023. It's the Winery Dogs and the upcoming Black Star Riders album. Just nice. Two of my favorite bands right now. You guys are both killing it. Let me ask you, you knew Richie from his years in Mr. Big. Maybe you knew him even before that. When Mike Portnoy comes into the mix. Had you known him from other things? I mean, I know you guys are involved in Sons of Apollo.
Yes.
But prior to the Winery Dogs, did you and Mike know each other?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. We've known each other for a long time. He's got, as a matter of fact, he showed me a picture when we put out the new Talus record, 1985 this year, or last year. He had photos of his first Dream Theater rehearsal from when they first began, when they were, you know, young lads, and he was wearing a Talus shirt. So he used to come see me play in at the Lemoore's in Brooklyn as when he was in college, I think. So we've known each other a long time. We worked together on a bunch of records way early on in the mid 80s, and then we did a Who tribute together.
Wow.
Myself, Paul Gilbert, Gary Cherone went out and played a whole evening of Who music, and it was quite wonderful. Then we had another band with Portnoy, McAlpine, Sheehan, Sherinian, which later turned into Sons of Apollo with the addition of Ron Bumblefoot and Jessica Soto. But that came after the Winery Dogs had already formed. So when Mike came to me and said, we should find a singing guitar player and start a band, I go, good idea. Who do you have in mind? And so we happened to be talking with Eddie Trunk, and he goes, Richie Kotzen. And I went, oh, of course, Richie, because Richie and I go way back
right
to when we first got to L.A. And we have been friends for decades and worked together a bunch. We did a tour in Japan opening for the Stones for five shows, just me, Richie, and a drummer named Tal Bergman, I believe. I just went over there and opened the show, and pretty amazing to be playing with the Stones. So we go way back. So we got together. We all knew each other. We all worked with each other. We have all been through everything together. So personality-wise, it was a very good fit. And the chemistry within the band is wonderful, which I think really helps when you're putting music together and putting a show together, because everybody gets along fine and we all have a lot of mutual respect for each other, and everybody does his job as they're supposed to. You know, people are really serious about doing what they do. I spend every morning, I feed the cat, come down here, hit this for hours. Richie's just a tireless touring, writing and performing. And Mike is pretty legendary for, yes, how much work he actually does, and how much recording and how much touring and performing he does, besides doing so much in the background as well, that things that need to be done to get a band up on stage and get things working. So it's been working very well on that level. So when we get in a room to write, things kind of fall together nicely.
And I think you touched on, I believe the number one thing though, in all of this is getting along. You got to get along, because you're going to be especially if you're going to go do a tour and you're going to be with these guys 24/7, that, I mean, you guys can be the best of the best, but if you're not getting along, it's not working.
I agree. And I always tell people, you know, when you're starting a band, the hanging out is almost as important, sometimes more important than the music, because you're going to be together at every airport, checking your luggage, getting your luggage, getting on the plane, dealing with everything imaginable on a tour bus for hours at a time. We do some, you know, sometimes you do 18-hour drives on a tour bus. You got to go to one part of the country for another, or from Sicily to Oslo, Norway. It's a long drive. You know, you have to put up with that stuff. And what might be cute and funny in rehearsals, when you have to deal with it 24/7, it can drive you out of your mind. So all of us are conscientious, understanding human beings, and we watch out for each other as well. So I think that reflects in the music too, if I may dare say, that when we're on stage, we're watching each other. You know, if some guy makes a left turn, we follow him, or we hold the anchor till he can get back to where he wants to be. There's a, improvisationally, the band, the Winery Dogs, has always been one of our strong points, I believe, that we can go off and do something and the other guys kind of automatically know what to do, where to go, because we're kind of on that same, like, ESP. I got great ESP with Mike Portnoy, bass player, drummer, because he plays a drum fill and I play a bass riff that matches it, even though we never rehearsed it or never talked about it or never even mentioned it. Part of a song comes, he'll go, chicka da ba ba, and I'll play chicka da ba ba on bass. And we look at each other like, how did you know I was going to? Well, no, how did you know I was going to play that? So it's a pretty cool thing. It makes being on stage a lot of fun, watching that ESP go and working with each other. And having three guys in a band makes it super easy, because I'm watching Mike and Richie. Richie's watching me and Mike. Mike's watching us both, and so it's a little easier to keep your eye on two guys than 11.
It's almost like magic, if you think about it. I mean, between the drummer and the bass player, especially,
It's a funny thing. It's hard to explain sometimes. And I kind of automatically have that. That was my thing. From the very first time I was in the same room with a bass and a drummer, a dear friend of mine around the corner from where I live as a little kid, his band would rehearse, but I was a little kid. I couldn't go inside. My big brother and sisters could, but I was a little kid. I had to wait outside. So one day I go over and there's nobody around and they let me come in. It was just the bass player, Joe, and the drummer, Tommy, and they were playing. And I said, Joe, where's the rest of the band? He goes, well, we practice bass and drums, because when he hits a bass drum, you know, it's his bass drum, I got to play a bass note at the same time. Right. So I thought, aha, that's one of the most fundamental important things for bass players to know. And amazing, I'll sit down with guys that have been playing for 10 or 15 years, and they didn't know that. So I got lucky to find out right away about that connection between bass and drums. It's supremely important. Drums give you time, but what key are we in?
Right.
Now, and bass connects rhythm and melody. Time and pitch were the thing in between the two that connects them. So my relationship with the drummer is supremely important, and I enjoy playing with Mike very much.
Well, you've played with some amazing drummers on record and on tours, you know, Mike, Greg Bissonette, Pat Torpy. How long does it take you to lock in with a new guy when you get in the room? How long does it take for the two of you to get to that point?
Oddly, it's pretty automatic. Right. I can tell right away. When I go to see a band, I'm watching the drummer first almost always. And then if it's all good, then I'll see who else is on the stage. Oh, look, they got a guitar player too. So I'm right on that right away. That's my thing. My wife and I watched a Santana video on YouTube last night with Dennis Chambers on drums. And I play with him in a band called Niacin. And he is probably one of the greatest drummers ever. We'll be right back. and certainly one of the greatest drummers alive. And man, he is just so great. But just watching him in another artist band, some European show that Santana played, I kind of automatically, I just felt a oneness with him right away because we played together so much. And I've learned so much from him about time. Wow, he's just a grandmaster. So I learned a lot from many drummers, and I've been very, very lucky to play with some incredible guys. Terry Bozzio, you mentioned Greg Bissonette, of course, Pat Torpy, what a fantastic player. Really, God rest his soul. He's just my closest musical friend and one of the finest drummers I've ever known. And so many other guys. So I'm a drummer guy.
That's when I know that I'm seeing a good band, is when I go to see someone live and I don't know who to watch because everyone is killing it. You know, yeah. Sometimes you go and you're like, oh, this guy's the whole thing, so I'll just watch him. But a band like Winery Dogs, you can watch everybody.
It's a three-ring circus.
The three-ring circus.
Which one do I watch? No, we, we also try to hand off the focus. For me, I want the focus to be on Richie when he's singing, you know.
Right.
And I want this focus to be on the song. Then everybody will have a spot or a section, even almost in every song, where we do a little thing or do something. And I could play, since it's a three-piece band, as a bass player, I've got a lot of room to move. There's no keyboards, there's no rhythm guitar, there's no horn section or strings or anything. So I can move around and imply a lot more notes to match up with Richie's chord changes and move things around. A bass, you can actually change the whole way a chord sounds by moving the root somewhere else and moving it to a different note. So we all try, and Mike, of course, is such an accomplished player. He could probably solo through every song and get away with it because he does the appropriate right things
that sound
right. And that's a key thing. If you're going to play it more, if it's right, it works good. If not, it's a train wreck. So we try to keep an eye on each other, balance it out, keep it going. There's one song we do from the first record called Regret, and slow song. And it's so touching. And it's just one of my most favorite songs I've ever performed on.
How many times are we gonna play the game? Thinking that it's gonna change. I wish I could somehow forget your face. It ain't easy to turn.
And I'm playing one big giant note for a long time before I hit the next one, because that's what you got to do for that beautiful song. So it's an interesting dynamic between musicians on stage on what they're doing and how it all works. I could talk about it, obviously, a long time.
Yeah, I want to talk about Pat Torpy real quick. I live in Woodland Hills, California, so I got to see one of your final shows with Pat out at the Canyon Club, because it's literally in my backyard. And you guys were, Matt Starr was with you guys, and Pat was in a diminished role, but still there, you know, smiling as big as possible and having a great time with you guys. And I got to meet you guys all individually after the show as a fan and get your autograph on my Lean Into It LP.
Right.
And Pat, for me, didn't seem to be, as he left, having the best time physically, maybe, yeah, even though he got in the car and drove home. And when I asked him to sign, he was a little bit shaky. And I said to him, I go, Pat, if you're not feeling up to it, it's totally okay. And he said, no way. I love to sign. And that was pretty special. And
He was just a giant of a man. He was a wonderful human being, a great father to his son and a wonderful husband to his wife, and a solid citizen. He was probably my closest musical friend of my life, really. We thought the same about many, many things, and we had the same outlet. We came up, though we didn't know each other when we were young, we had an almost parallel beginning. He got into bands and started playing in clubs and learning every song, and I was in a band playing in clubs, learning every song. Eventually he did a couple of originals, blah, 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 went on to whatever you went on to. So we had a parallel universe in many ways and thought the same about a lot of things. He toured as long as he could.
Yeah.
Special thanks to Matt Starr for coming in and doing the heavy lifting on the tour. He played the drum kit where we had Pat to the side on some percussion and a mic to sing, because we needed his voice as essential to our harmony to have Pat sing.
Yeah.
And he was such a great voice on top of being an amazing player. And Matt Starr did a great job. He really did. And we were very indebted to him. And on top of it, Matt understood the dynamic of what was going on. We were all there kind of for Pat.
Right.
To allow him to get up on stage and perform. And it's and so many people in the audiences when we played like that in Europe, in Japan, in all over the USA, you could see the look on people's faces, you know, because they knew what was going down. Pat did too. But it was important for us to say, you got to have a reason to get up in the morning, and it's going to be tough for you. But we're there for you. Get up, get on stage, and let's do it. And I think that was a very good thing for him mentally, to be able to get up on that stage every night and go just the same in spite of all the troubles that his affliction was giving him. Quite a heroic endeavor on his part to get up there every night. And, you know, he was losing his balance a bit, too. We'd go up on stage and there's stairs. I'd always be right behind him. Right? I got you, bro.
Yeah.
You know, and he was and you could tell also one of the symptoms of that particular affliction of Parkinson's is you tend to write your name smaller because you're a little shaky. And yeah. I noticed we'd all sign a record cover and Pat would be. His signature would be very small because he was starting to really get to him a bit.
Yeah.
Sad to see, but the good part of it is it really illustrates what humans are capable of in spite of anything. And I've some people have had it even much worse, but still got up and did what they had to do. So we're very, very proud of Pat for being the kind of human being he was. And right to the end, he took care of every fan and signed everything and did everything required of him and more, and did it with a smile. And Mr. Big plays any further, it's going to be in tribute to Pat Torpy for sure.
Yeah, well, we always say here, rock in peace. So rock in peace, Pat Torpy. But
I saw that for the first time the other day, and that was that's an appropriate RIP.
Yeah.
For Pat. Again, what a wonderful guy. And I love seeing comments about him on my posts when people mention him, when I'm talking about Mr. Big or whatever. And there's immense love and respect for him everywhere. And it was an honor to know him, but to play him with him was even greater. Quite wonderful. Thanks for bringing it up, actually.
Well, you're welcome, and no disrespect to Pat, but we will now pivot to Winery Dogs 3. I know that's it's a weird segue, but we all love Pat, and he would be happy that you had new music out with Winery Dogs too. So
he would. He was when I did the records with Dennis Chambers, Pat was blown away because he didn't know much about Dennis, as I didn't really prior to the first time I heard him. And I remember he took me aside. We were in Japan doing some promo on a new record years ago. And he goes, Billy, the thing you did with Dennis, nice. It was unbelievable. And so he became so enamored with Dennis, he went into the practice, mates rehearsal in North Hollywood. And he had a drum room in there. And people and everybody would rehearse there. Van Halen, Tom Jones, David Bowie, Guns N' Roses, everybody went to mates. Just a little place, but we all loved it. And people said, who's drumming in there? That's Pat. You know, next day, who's that's Pat again. He'd be in there every day working. Not unlike myself. I wake up, feed the cat, come down to my studio here and start to get to work. But he'd get up and go to his his little spot there, rehearsal spot, and he'd be at it every day, just working it out, inventing new stuff, fine-tuning his craft. It was pretty amazing. So he was always happy with some of the things I've done.
Nice. And
so I'm sure he would be pleased with this.
First single is Xanadu. Bands still make videos, people. Where was this video shot for Xanadu?
Amazingly, people thought it was computer generated. I saw a couple comments that that's not real, but that was in Malibu, which rhymes with Xanadu, up on a mountaintop overseeing the Pacific Ocean. The home was found by our video producer. They get location scouts that go out and look for locations. And this particular place was a $7 million home with a view. The view, it could have been a shack and still been worth $7 million with that view. But it was a beautiful home. And they use it a lot for movies and TVs and events. So they found this spot for us and put us up there. And we had the wind blowing behind us. And if I would have stepped back 5 feet, it was a long drop, long way down. But you could see for 20 miles, it was unbelievable, the whole ocean out behind us. And they had drones flying and quite a great videographer we had for Xanadu. He's the same guy who did Mad World as well. But he did a great job. We had a blast. It was a little cold and windy, though, so we had the wind behind us. So
so it wouldn't blow you off the cliff.
Good thing.
It's keeping you on land. Yeah, the second single is Mad World, just released. Richie's vocals are amazing, and the lyrics have just a positive vibe, in my opinion. This album is so good. I think it's, for me, it's your best one.
Oh, very kind of you. Thank you.
You guys are just continuing to get better.
Well, thank you very much. We live our lives, and as you live, your musical life expands. And when we get together to do a new record, we've had, since the last record, 6 or 7 years of living to add to our what we do on our instruments. So I think that might have been a factor. Plus the fact that we've the first record was pretty straight up rock. The second record got a little experimental, but still had straight up rock in it. And this one here, I've heard it said that it's kind of a combination of those two. We do a little experimenting, but we really wanted to get back to a lot of things we did on the first record, just straight out hit that. And a few things more funkified on this record a little bit in a rock way, which I like. The song choice on the record goes a very broad spectrum of stylistic and emotional moods.
Now, in the past, when you guys would tour, you would throw in some other songs here and there. One of my favorites is, it's one of my favorite Mr. Big songs from the Kotzen era is Shine. You guys would actually do that live. Now that you have three albums, will it just be Winery Dogs material, or you still maybe throw in a surprise here and there?
Well, so far, that's what we're going to do with the three records. We'd like to represent all three of them well in the live show. And there's been no talk about doing anything else. When we first started, we had to kind of throw extra songs in because we didn't have enough songs to do a show. You know, it was only like 10 or 11 songs on the first record, I believe. I forgot. And we need more songs than that for a show. So we had to throw a few things in. And it was fun doing them. It was a blast. We did. And we did one. Well, now we did I'll Be There by the Temptations.
Nice.
Tore it up. A couple things like that. Fool Around, Fell in Love. That was that YouTube video's got millions of views from the Japan tour video we did with that. It was our very first show. So we have enough now to do that, but maybe on the next tour, after the fourth album, we'll be able to mix it up even more and bring some old stuff back in. But right now, we're excited to do the new stuff. I'm here practicing it in my little studio, making sure I can remember all the words, and I'm pretty well prepared to start tomorrow if I had to, but give myself a little bit more room to practice.
Is that what you do now, Billy? You're focused on what you're doing right now, but you're still looking ahead to what's the next thing is going to be too. Is that what keeps you moving and excited about music?
Yeah, I'm really thankful that built into me somehow, I don't know why or how, is just a relentless drive to just do more and better. It doesn't mean faster or more notes. It just means to fine tune what I do on this thing. And related to it, my songwriting and my vocals and everything else like that. So I'm always really hitting it hard. And as far as looking in the future goes, the next Winery Dogs record, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We could do any number of things. Make a left turn, make a right turn, stay right on the highway, go on the roundabout. Who knows which way we'll be traveling. But I want to be prepared for any eventuality as far as my playing goes,
yeah,
and my writing skills and my arranging chops to be able to do anything. A lot of my practice on bass, which is kind of a microcosm of that point of view, is mechanical. I want to make sure my hands can do anything. It's probably a spam call. Yeah, spam. Spam is everywhere.
That's from Fred Flintstone.
It sounded like it, but it's kind of take off. So the mechanics of how my hands move, not so much what notes I'm going to, but just to make it so I create a little machine that can do anything I need it to do. So in any eventuality, oh, I need to do this other thing that I never thought of musically before, but my hand will do it because I've already worked that out. So it's kind of a different approach to playing than some other players. I'm sure there's other people that do it as well, though, where I just try to prepare myself for any eventuality on that fretboard. So similarly, musically, as far as songwriting and recording and all that, I like to be prepared for any eventuality. So whatever comes up in the future, I'll be able to handle or at least get an idea of what to do.
You brought up faster and you brought up more notes, which made me think of the song Shy Boy, which was a Talas song, but you also recorded a version famously on Eat 'Em and Smile. Did you bring that song to Dave, or did Dave know of that song and he wanted to do it?
He knew of it and wanted to do it. He came to see, he came to see us play in Talas on our Talas Yngwie tour, summer of '85, twice. And prior to both of those times, I had already had a meeting with him about we were going to play together. So when he came to see us, that was the barn burner. One of the closing songs of the night, and he liked it, and very kind of him to bring it in and have the band do it, and I'm forever grateful for that.
Not only that, but it's a Billy Sheehan composition, and then for that song, that song probably, and no offense, got heard more from being on Eat 'Em and Smile than it did from being on the Talas album.
Oh, way more, yeah.
Yeah, so, and more mailbox money for you too, probably.
Yeah, Dave was very generous and allowed me to keep my publishing on that, because the leader of a band doesn't have to. They say, hey, I like your song, we'll use it, but I want the publishing. And you could say no and get nothing,
right,
or say yes and get at least a writer's credit or something.
Right.
But Dave was great. He's very generous. So he never even brought it up. He just put the song on there, and I got compensated for that, which is very, very nice. But
Here's the thing. I've never had a chance to ask interview anyone who's worked closely with David Lee Roth. And my only question about Dave is, the Dave that I see as a fan on interviews and back in the 80s on MTV and in print and always, that doesn't seem like a guy that you could work with in the studio, because he couldn't possibly be monkey hour like that all the time. Right, Billy? So could you tell me what it's like to really work on music with David Lee Roth in the studio as musicians without cameras and without the show? What's that like? Is he focused and into the music?
Absolutely. And he's a ball of enthusiasm. You know, okay, what's that part there? Yeah, put that. It sounds like a verse. Okay, let's read it. And it'll leave the room for, okay, then give me something that sounds kind of like a chorus. Yeah, that's great, cool. And he's always, we had a blast, Eat 'Em and Smile, writing it in down in his basement where Van Halen was born down there. And it was a riot. We had a blast. He was very supportive. You know, we played Elephant Gun, and Steve did this wild lick. And I'm just kind of playing bass underneath it. And Dave goes, Stevie, that's cool. Billy, you double it. You know, so when he left the room, Steve, how does that go? You know, so we figured it out. And he was all into the soloing and all the stuff we did on there. More, yes. Give me more. Let's do more. It was his idea to do the our solos together, Steve and I. Because when we first couple of shows out on that tour, I go up and do my bass solo. Yeah. And Steve would do his guitar solo. Yeah. And a couple shows in, Dave goes, it's not doing it for me. It's got to be more entertaining. Because Dave, fully understanding Joe Sixpack in the crowd, who isn't a musician, a lot of that stuff, what's the point? You know, they don't, you know, the musician people get it, but the non-musicians don't. So he said, well, you know, Steve, you go out there and start playing a solo, and Billy, you come up behind him and stop and push him aside, and then you do your thing. He pushes you, then you're back and forth. And we did that, and the crowd went out of their minds. That was all Dave's idea. So he was a really supportive, wonderful guy. And I think he's it's unsung how much he had to do with a lot of the music he was involved with before Eat 'Em and Smile. I think he had a lot to do with how things went down melodically. Mm-hmm. And people, I just read Ted Templeman's book where he talks a lot about the whole situation. And Dave's lyrics, brilliant, really great stuff. Just a great kind of a mood set that was lurid, but not, you know, slutty. You know, it was intriguing. Mean Streets. Ain't Talking About Love. You know, it had a mood in a sense that was heavy, but it wasn't funeral music, as he used to call the dirgy, down, heavy stuff. It was alive, but it had real sensibilities. And it was really an incredible experience. And I'm a better musician for having worked with Dave, for sure.
Well, I was lucky enough. I did see that Eat 'Em and Smile tour at the Pittsburgh Civic Arena when you guys came through. And were those the biggest crowds you had ever played for up until then?
Yeah, pretty much. Though we opened up for Van Halen and Talas, and we played to their crowds in 1980 for about 30 shows.
Yeah, so that's big too. Yeah.
So we did. So I was pretty used to being on stages like that. That was cool. And it just had thousands of gigs under my belt. So it was a quick adaptation. So it wasn't a problem. The biggest crowd ever was Mr. Big played for on the beach in Santos Beach outside of Sao Paulo, Brazil. And we didn't know when we got there, it was our first Brazilian shows. We didn't know that they were playing Mr. Big songs on the daytime soap operas as background music.
Wow.
Just Take My Heart and all that stuff. So, and when you get into TV and soap operas, it's a lot bigger audience than rock and roll, especially in that country happened to be. So we got out there. It was Mr. Big headlining, Henry Rollins, the Lemonheads, and a local band. Well, it's a name I forgot, but I've since met them a couple times. And, the local band got up first, and there's a lot of people. And I got up come back from the dressing room and look out. There's a lot of people out here. Well, this is going to be a good show. The Lemonheads got up, and I said, there's a lot of people here. And then Henry Rollins got up and did it, and it was out of control. So I said to the guys, geez, this is going to be quite a night. This is as far as the eye could see. We ended up with 100,000 people on the beach, and it was just a total chaos show. In a good way. We were flying. We were at the top of our game. We hit everything right on the money. We had a blast. The crowd went out of their minds. And there was, of course, security and police between us and the crowd. The last two songs come, and they left. They just walked. So us on the stage, a little space, a little security thingy, and 100,000 people. And now out in the audience, it's getting dark. We see bonfires starting and people growing. And it's getting, I think there's probably even more people there now.
Yeah.
So as we're playing, we weren't scared, but we were just wondering, how is this going to play out when we end? You know, are they just going to keep encoring us until the sun comes up? Who knows? So we were playing. It's time, you know, we did the last song, said our goodnight, and we looked in the background, and the military was, the army trucks were pulling in, and soldiers were getting out to disperse the crowd. So That was my biggest show.
That's amazing. That is amazing. I want to mention the song, track 3 on the album Breakthrough on Winery Dogs 3. Your bass work is stellar on this one. And this might be my favorite one on the album. It's really great.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I have the great fortune to be in a situation where I'm with every band I play in, where people want to hear things I do and want to let me do my thing. And that doesn't mean that I play a lot, like I said before, but, you know, sometimes a very simple bass run is supremely satisfying for me. And also, Jay Rustin just got a great mix for us. I hear every note everybody plays and hear Richie's vocals right there, as they should be. So I have a lot of people to thank for when people hear what I do. I'm thankful to a lot of people.
The tour starts. Let me get it here. I have it written down. Tour starts Greensburg, Pennsylvania, which is I grew up like right around that area. So that's kind of wild. Where's the date? There, February 15th at the Palace Theater in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Why Greensburg? Why'd you pick that place to start the tour?
We don't choose where we play.
Yeah. Someone else sets it up.
The booking agents do a routing so you don't go from Bangor, Maine to San Diego to Miami to Anchorage, because your travel costs, well, you might as well sell your house.
All right.
They got to route it so you start in a place and go to the other places you're playing in reasonable amount of time of a bus ride. Though sometimes there are 16 to 18 or even longer bus rides in the U.S. and in Europe as well. But it has to be routed, and they people are surprised sometimes that they think we choose where we play and what venues and how much they charge for parking, and we got nothing to do with it.
All right.
But Greensburg was a great choice because there used to be a club there called Stage One. Do you remember that?
I don't remember Stage One.
Maybe it may have been gone by the time you were around. But we used to play there in Talos all the time. And Paul Gilbert used to be in the audience. I remember a real tall kid standing in the audience. That was Paul. And his band actually opened up for us one time there. And a couple of other great clubs in the Pittsburgh area. Greensburg is a Pittsburgh area.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of near and dear to me as a member of Talos, because I played there so much. I'm sure I'll run into a lot of old friends. It's going to be great. So we're excited about it. And we'll play anywhere. We're open to play anywhere. We want to play everywhere. But we have to wait for some place to actually book us, contact the promoter or contact the booking agent and take a date and do that. See, because we have a product that we're offering.
Right.
We can't choose who decides to purchase it or take it.
So, exactly.
If I could, we'd play everywhere. But we got to wait for a particular city or venue or country even to invite us in, especially with international travel, because you can't just go in and play. You get any work permits and tax documentation, custom stuff for your gear coming in and out, all kinds of things. You know, people will say, you should play in Chile. We could fly in. Maybe we could fly in without a visa, but we certainly couldn't play without a work permit.
Well, Billy, I know that you can play in SoCal without a work permit, but there's no SoCal date.
No, there isn't, because as you'll see in the bottom of that little thing with all the dates, more dates coming. So,
fingers crossed.
They book a big chunk, and then there's maybe a week off or two, and then we go up on the second leg. Only the first chunk
is announced.
Released. Some of the international dates are on there only because they got to be booked way, way in advance.
Right.
Because there's so much more to the logistics of playing in another country on another continent. So that's an important thing as well. But even that, there's way more shows in Europe, in South America, probably Southeast Asia and Japan as well. We're going to try for Australia. But we L.A. was my home for 32 years.
Yeah.
I could never not play L.A. I'll play every night in LA if I could. It would be fantastic. San Francisco as well, San Diego, Phoenix, the Upper West Coast up into Seattle and Portland, places like that. So, we're dying to play everywhere. And many, many more dates are coming, I'm happy to say.
All right, a couple more things, then I'm going to let you go. You're in Nashville now. Is that where you make your home?
Yeah, it's been here for 5 years, and we love it. It's just great.
Excellent. In 2010, after a 9-year hiatus with Mr. Big, you guys come back with the album What If, and Paul Gilbert returns. And the first single was Undertow, and you have a co-writing credit on that. And after 9 years, I had no idea what Mr. Big was going to bring to the table. And when I heard Undertow, I was flipping out at how hard rocking it was, how great the lyrics were, and how fantastic you guys all sounded.
Like cyanide, impossible, but just for the vibe. How long can she keep on chasing something wrong? Memories of how she could have made it. The waves are crashing down.
Ever since What If, just all those albums have been really strong, in my opinion. I think you guys are still doing great work as Mr. Big.
Thank you very much. Yeah, What If was a great record. We enjoyed playing that very much. And the songs translated live really well. We did a lot of touring from that record. Prior to that, now we also have we had the 30-year anniversary of Lean Into It. And they commemorated it with a vinyl version remastered, and they did a couple of Music Minus One, where they removed the bass and so bass players can play along, or remove the guitar so guitar players can play along.
Very cool.
I did a few playthroughs on video, and it was funny because I went to the studio to do the playthrough. I'm just going to play the bass part and the rest of the record plays while I do my original bass part. I never thought about, I should maybe go over this a couple times before I forgot it. So I remember doing I think it was Daddy, Brother, Love, a Little Boy. And we're about to start and I realized, oh, geez, I haven't even listened to it for a couple years. But I got lucky. And there was very few flubs, almost none of them noticeable. So I got through. But it was so great to have people comment on that record. Because that record for me, my big three. Eat 'em, Smile, Mr. Big, Lean Into It, first Winery Dogs record. Those are my big three. And so
nice.
That record being out on its 30-year anniversary was a wonderful time. And it spoke so much also about what we mentioned before with Pat Torpy. What a driving force. What a wonderful guy. What an incredible drummer and singer he was, contributing to very much to that sound. Mr. Big was a very equal situation for everyone. We all had input on songs. We all sang. We all had our thing, and it was just a fantastic experience in that band.
My next question is: I always ask a listener to give me a question, and a friend of the show, Dave Festini from New Jersey, he wanted me to ask: was there really going to be an Eat 'em and Smile reunion show at a bowling alley in Los Angeles? Was that true? Were you guys all in that bowling alley together, the four of you? Or is that a rumor?
It is an amazing phenomenon to see an event travel through time and history and watch it morph into many different things. And almost every interview I do, somebody asks about it. That was about maybe 7 or 8 years ago. It was a gig. It was a club. It was attached. There was a bowling alley attached to it, but it was a club where they had a jam night. every Tuesday. And me and Steve and Greg were going to go up and do Yankee Rose and Shy Boy. Right. And somebody said, see if Dave's in town. And he was. So he was going to come on down. And simple as that. No pay, no rehearsal, no nothing.
Just fun.
Just come on down. And unfortunately, the club blew it, and they started letting – I think it's free to get into it. They started letting more and more people in. The place holds about 600 legally. I've seen it at 750 on a jumping night, and they had about 1,200, 1,500 people in there. And all my friends over there said you couldn't drink because you couldn't raise your arms up.
Oh, my God.
Jammed in. I thought, man, if anything happened here, this is going to be a – horrible catastrophe.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, we were on stage ready to go. Curtain down. They have a curtain in this particular place. Ready to go. And I saw the firemen come in and they said, no way, shut it down. And we offered to appease them by allowing some people to leave. So they made an announcement. If anyone could, everybody's saying, like, I ain't leaving.
No one's leaving.
That's it. But the great thing about that was me, Steve, Greg, and Dave got to hang in the back dressing room area for hours and talking and having a great time. I posted a photo about it, posted the whole story several times. So, it's amazing how I get the exact same question in the exact same format from the interview before yours. Is it true you weren't a bowling alley? No, we were like set up between the pins and everything. It's a club on Vine Street, I believe, just up from Sunset, because the line that night went down Vine and around Sunset when the club was already overflowing. It was already too crowded, and the line went all the way down and snaked down Hollywood Boulevard. So wish it would have happened, but now it is part of lore.
Well, thank you, Dave Festini, for making me ask a question that Billy Sheehan answers on a daily basis. Now I feel stupid.
No, okay. It's not your fault. It's okay.
All right. Let me tell everyone where they can find everything about the band and you. Websites, thewinerydogs.com or billysheehan.com. At Twitter, @thewinerydogs or @billyonbass. Instagram, @thewinerydogs and @billysheehanonbass. Now, final thing, Billy. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
As our playout song today, I always ask the artist to pick a song from the new album that they would like me to use as our playout song. What would you like to pick from the Winery Dogs 3?
Well, I know we've just released the two singles and we haven't released anything else yet. So if I pick one that hasn't been released, I wonder how much trouble I'm going to get in.
Well, this episode's going to drop the day before the album comes out.
Okay, now you mentioned your favorite track.
I said it was Breakthrough.
Let's do it.
All right, everybody enjoy my favorite track, Breakthrough. Thank you so much, Billy Sheehan.
I can't look into your eyes. I'm
Thank you for having me, and I hope I see you around very soon.
Well, if you play SoCal, I'm definitely going to be contacting your PR person and come by and say hello.
Please let me know. I'd love to shake your hand and say hi, and we'll have a glass of wine or a beer together or something.
I would love it, Billy. You take great care man. And continued success, and have a great tour.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.